Hello and welcome to Transmission. Today we're joined by Delphine, the Managing Director of ENGIE's pumped hydro business. The conversation covers the Norwegian and Fostinjog pumped hydro stations, how they operate, the refurbishment works that are being done, and some record-breaking valves. We also talk about taking St. Paul's Cathedral deep into the mountainside and the specifics on how these assets actually run. I particularly enjoyed the conversation on Delphine's engineering journey. Where did it all begin? How did she get hooked? And what advice does she have for people who are interested in the space and maybe their parents? If you enjoyed this episode, please do hit like and subscribe. It really helps us reach more people. And with that, let's jump in. Delphine, welcome to Transmission.
Thank you for your invitation. My pleasure.
Well, I'm very excited about this episode. So let's kick off with who are you and who is ENGIE?
Well, I'm Delphine. I have more than 30 years experience in the energy sector. I'm an engineer by education. I mean, my first half of my career, I was mainly dealing with gas infrastructure projects. Underground storage, LNG terminals, transport, both in France but also abroad. Then I spent 8 years working on the oil and gas business, more as an executive in executive roles, including in the UK. I spent some time in the UK when we used to have some oil and gas business there, so supporting the growth in a number of countries. And I would say for the last 10 years, I joined more corporate functions, mainly dealing with supervising the industrial projects with the ENGIE Group across the world. First, all the technologies we handled at the time, and then I moved to the renewable space. Because 4 years ago, we totally reorganized the group to really focus on the renewable growth and the energy transition. So I led also a team there to help developing and building those assets across the world. And more recently, at the end of last year, I joined the UK, rejoined the UK to become the managing director of our hydro assets in the UK. So namely, First Hydro.
Okay, and your hydro assets in the UK, do you want to just describe what they are?
Well, there are mainly two assets. Dinovig, which is the biggest and the fastest cycling pumped hydro in the whole of Europe, with 1.8 gigawatt of capacity. It was built and commissioned in 1984. And Fostinjog, the older one, which was commissioned in 1963, with 360 megawatt of capacity. So these two assets, of course, are reaching their end of life. So we do need to refurbish them, which means basically changing the whole mechanical and electrical system so we can give them another 25 years of life.
Okay. Yeah. And we're definitely going to come on to that topic in a second. But so three pumped hydro sites. So
Two pumped hydro.
So Fostinjog, Dinovig, and then First Hydro.
Oh, First Hydro is the company who is the owner of those assets, yes.
Okay, well, that clears it up. Perfect. And then I asked about who ENGIE were, and I think people will know, but let's just give a bit of context in terms of...
Absolutely. So first ENGIE role in First Hydro, we are the owner of First Hydro at 75%, together with our partner CDPQ, who is an investment fund from Canada, who owns also 25%. ENGIE as a whole, it's a worldwide utility, and we are committed, you know, to support the energy transition in all the countries we are present. We currently operate in 30 countries all across the world, covering all of the energy sector from the upstream with the production through renewable, wind, solar, hydro. We have also a fleet of CCGTs. We also involved in all the transportation and all the infrastructure for gas and power transportation, and down to the distribution and also the sales to either B2B or B2C client. We're also very involved into the what we call decentralized assets and decentralized energy for third party, for clients like towns or B2B clients, industrial clients, to support their decarbonization. For example, we are the leader in all that what we call heating and cooling systems in the world. We operate a number of them all across the world, in Europe, in the Middle East, in North America, etc. Mm-hmm.
And from the battery side, we obviously know your team in Australia, and we also know your team as, for example, in ERCOT as well. Like it's a,
absolutely.
ENGIE as a business just has this huge breadth.
Absolutely. We're also aiming, of course, to accelerate in all the flexibility assets, especially batteries, but not only. We also operate a power pump storage like First Hydro, but we do operate others in Europe, like in Belgium, in Portugal and Germany. Mm-hmm. But definitely batteries are the fastest solution to cope with the high level of intermittency brought by renewable. And it will continue to grow with the growth of renewables. So we do need to accelerate in the space of batteries to support that growth.
Yeah. And we'll come back onto speed in a second in terms of like how fast you can respond and how fast you can build things. But let's go from very broad. Let's bring it all the way back to De Norwegg. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about what De Norwegg actually is.
Well, De Norwegg, it's an incredible asset. It was built in the 80s. It was built into the mountain, deep into the mountain. So there's something like 16 kilometers of tunnels and pipework underneath that has been digged there. There is caverns that I was told are big enough to have the St. Paul Cathedral, you know, hosting it.
Okay.
So first of all, you know, the civil work is incredible. And so that was to host all of the mechanical and electrical systems. But this is mainly two lakes, one upper lake where we store the water. So we pump up the mountain, the water when the electricity is abundant. And that's especially when we have a lot of wind. So it's a lot of renewable electricity that we are able to use and store through that pumping up the upper lake. And then when we have peak demands, we need to support the system. Then we can release this water really fast through our turbines down to the lower lake. That's okay. Very simple. And in terms of principle, it's not, it's this, that this has been existed for more than 100 years, the technology, but the size of it, the scale of it is incredible.
Okay. And so when you say, okay, I need power, someone presses a button and water flows down these tunnels, hits the turbine, generates power.
Absolutely.
How long does that take to...
Well, if we are from complete stop, it takes between 30 and 60 seconds to go to full power. But we are often in what we call a spin generation, where we basically spinning air and we are synchronized with the grid, and we can go to full power in less than 20 seconds.
Okay, so the turbines are already spinning, and then essentially you're adding on.
It's just about opening the valve and letting the water in.
Okay, and I think listeners will then say, "Well, hold on, why is this thing spinning? Like, why is it in spin gen mode? What's it providing to the grid?"
It does not provide anything to the grid, but it is synchronized with the grid. So in terms of frequency, it doesn't take as long to, because we already synchronized. So when we let the water in, we are ready to produce and inject to the grid.
Okay.
It's just that additional element that it adds, yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned with De Norwegg and Festinjog that you are essentially, these are assets that have been going, well, De Norwegg since 1984, you mentioned.
Yeah.
And you're now starting to replace parts of them.
Absolutely.
What does that look like?
Well, what does that look like? We already started with Festinjog. The project started in 2017. So we changed already two of the units, so turbine and pump. We have two systems in a separate system in Festinjog. And we are currently changing the two remaining units. We have four units altogether in Festinjog. Hopefully, this will come back in operation during the winter 2025-2026. So that's basically what it is. We don't just remove the turbines, the pumps, refurbish and replace them, and put them back in place. We do replace the whole system because they're really on their last leg. I mean, you talk about flexible assets. I will give you a figure. I think that that not a lot of people know. We receive instructions of changing mode on the 10 units, four in Festinjog and six in De Norwegg. We receive 25,000 instructions per year to change mode. I mean, talking about flexibility. So yes, it has also a cost for the mechanical equipment and the electrical equipment. And that's why we need to replace them. Refurbishment will not be good enough.
So I'm thinking sort of, as with an engineering head on, I'm thinking about kind of the changing rates of strain and stress.
Absolutely.
On parts.
It comes with a lot of stress on all the mechanical equipment, the turbines, the valves, the pipework, etc. So yes.
Okay.
So we do replace the bulk and of the units, and especially the turbine and pumping elements.
Okay. And I would love to know a little bit more about how you actually do that. So when you say I need to swap out the pump, is it as easy as kind of, okay, well, just turn off this bit here and turn off this bit here and then swap this bit out in here?
Or do it's you have not
to
as sort easy.
Of, do you have to drain everything? How does that work?
Well, I can give you the example. At the moment, we have drained the whole station for Dinovig because we are replacing the main inlet valve. So basically, at the bottom of those shafts, you imagine we have a manifold and then we have valves, you know, that really isolate from the turbine. So we do need to drain the whole station to be able to replace those valves. And that's what we're currently doing. And okay. We will finish by the end of this, before the end of this year. And then once this is done and we have a good insulation of between the water and the rest of the equipment, then we can carry on with the replacement of the rest. But it's important, of course, we can't do that replacement with the station full of water. Absolutely
yes.
not.
Right? Okay. And you used to be able to go and visit Dinorwick and go and kind of look around and kind of see how it worked. Can you still go today?
No, not at the moment. We have a lot of work ongoing. Festiniog was never visited, but for Dinorvig, we already are very busy this year because we, as I said, we are in the middle of the drain down. We are replacing this huge valve, which are 160 tons. So it's massive valves, 2.5 meter in diameter. Probably one of the largest valves that exist in the world, I guess.
Okay.
Plus a number of other electrical equipment, switch gear, switch, etc. So it's really not the right time to have visitors. So we do have occasionally some VIPs because we also want to communicate about our beautiful assets and what we're doing, what we're investing in. But not at the moment. But we do think that when things are a bit more back into steady state mode, we will reinstate some kind of visits. I think we have already a virtual visit that our communication team has filmed also, and I think is already available. I'm going to ask my colleague, but I think it's already available on YouTube. That virtual visit exists, and we will reinstate certainly something in the future.
I've definitely seen one of those videos when I've been looking in the past. So we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes.
Yes, it is possible. I think we need to do that because I think one of the things that struck me when I took my job, I met a lot of people, some working for First Hydro and some from the local area. And all of them, you know, all of them, they went, including the First Minister of Wales, who visited us the other day. All of them, they went when they were a kid to visit those assets. Yeah. And for some of them, it did trigger some appetite and curiosity to become an engineer.
I totally agree. I mean, I went to go and see Ratcliffe when I was much younger.
Yeah.
It's a massive coal station. But
absolutely.
Still, like, it gives you a sense of the scale and just how these things work. I think it does really kind of kickstart an interest in the space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, those assets are speaking for themselves. When you have a chance to visit them, you know, I mean, the endeavor and what the human brain can produce, you know, it's incredible. And that's probably one of the reasons I became an engineer when I was younger.
Absolutely. And going back to one of your points earlier about the just for the scale, so St Paul's Cathedral can fit inside some of the caverns within Dinorwig.
Absolutely.
Which I think is just like an incredible stat in terms of size. So I'd like to ask two questions. The first one's on the valve. Mm-hmm. Where do you get the world's largest valve from?
Well, those have been manufactured by our supplier, Andritz.
Okay.
So they've been fabricated in Germany, but with pieces coming from all over Europe.
Okay.
I mean, this is really specialized, and this is not something that we could have fabricated in the UK, unfortunately.
Yeah, super interesting. And then the total cost of this. So it sounds like switchgear, the world's largest valves. So many components are being swapped out. What does the sort of total bill come to?
I mean, overall, the program, since we started Festiniog in 2017, the program is going to be about £1 billion of refurbishment for the two stations. So we already committed and invested £250 million for refurbishing Festiniog and for preparing for the Dinorvig. So the replacement of the main inlet valve, as I said, is the preparation, and plus all of some of the electrical switch gear that we're replacing at the moment. So that's part of the cost already committed. And we would like to commit also to spend another £750 million to replace the six units in Dinorvig, the six massive units.
Those are the things that generate power.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Generate power and pumps up the water. It's the same turbine basically that does both.
Okay. Yeah. To ask like one sort of final question on Dinorvig, is it intended to run forever? It feels like there's replacements that have to happen every sort of 25 years, but will we always something like to not work?
Yeah, well, I think in theory, yes, it could, because we've been draining down, and it's the second time we do that. We did that already 2 years ago for replacing the first two valves. We're replacing the four remaining valves this year. There's been a lot of inspections and visits of the shafts, and the civil work is in perfect condition. So there's no reason, you know, once we have upgraded the mechanical and the electrical system, that we cannot carry on for a long time. I mean, we operate a lot of hydro assets all across the world, and some of them are as old as 70, 100 years old. And if it's the civil works, because that's the biggest investment, that's the biggest impact also, environmentally speaking. If it can goes on forever, if it's in good situation, it can goes on for a long, long time, yes.
Yeah. We had Kate Gilmartin on an episode about pumped hydro, I think maybe around 6 months ago. And she was talking about one pumped hydro asset in GB that's been running for, I think, 110 years.
Yeah, I would not be surprised. I mean, if you can change the mechanical parts, you know, of course, because it's wearing off, but if the civil holds, it can go for a long time.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It is actually some of our business cases, and we do buy a lot of hydro assets in the world, you know, and we refurbish them, so it's there's good business there.
Okay, and maybe let's then go on to sort of the competition. So we have pumped hydro assets, and we have had them for a long time, and I think we will have them for a long time. We're also starting to see technology like batteries coming through. NG work in both. Do you see them competing? Do you see them complementing each other? How does that work?
I mean, for all the support services to the grid, the batteries have been taking some of the market, you know, to the pump hydro. But what the batteries can bring is all the stability. The stability and the inertia to the grid, and that can be brought by these massive wheels. And I think it's 500 ton and the wheels of the turbine. So it's really important to support the grid, like also all the CCGTs. So that's what batteries can bring. I mean, maybe they will bring it one day, but what they don't bring also is the duration. Mm-hmm. At the moment, most batteries are built between 1-2 hours, maybe 4 hours, you know. But at the moment, in first hydro, if we've one turbine, we can hold for 36 hours, and with six turbines for 6 hours. So that's and I think the assets are under development have also longer duration for storage. So it is complementary. Yes, at the moment there's a little bit of competition for the short duration and very instantaneous support to the grid, but I think it will come as a complement in the coming years.
And to add a couple of stats onto that, so as of the end of May of 2025, the average duration in GB storage is 1.5 hours. That's a live stat and a live threshold that's being crossed.
Absolutely.
I'd say one thing that we have had some interesting conversations on, Daniel Duckwitz from SMA came on to talk about how most batteries are grid following in terms of their inverter, but we're now starting to see grid forming inverters. And so I think that will be one area where you might start to see almost synthetic inertia starting to compete with your sort of spinning pumped hydro. So maybe that's a topic for future debate.
Future debate, one step at a time.
Yes, exactly. And to be honest, grid forming inverters are very limited at the moment. We haven't seen that many of them rolled out, but I think it's a directional thing that the battery space is thinking about. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting to see. Let's now talk about the business model. So if I'm a pumped hydro site and I need to get funding for this, £1 billion is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. How do you get funding for that? How do you get confidence that this is all going to make sense from a business perspective?
Well, first of all, those assets are fully merchant. I think we don't have subsidies or we don't have CFDs. The only contract that we can get is a capacity market to secure part of the revenues. But the rest is fully merchant, and it's all down also to our know-how. We have a long experience on working and trading on the electricity market in the UK and in many countries, and it's down also to our expertise and our know-how to anticipate, predict, and play on the market mechanism that we can play to make sure that we have revenues to fund our.
Okay.
Our investments, yeah.
And is there a role for government in supporting pumped hydro? Did you mention you had one of the first ministers coming past in Norwich? Like, what's the origination of them coming to see it?
Well, one thing that we are interested in is to have sufficient support through the capacity market mechanism to refurbish fully the six turbine.
Okay.
At the moment, the rules are pointing towards refurbishing only four, because we would get maximum revenues for only four, and then it's kind of doesn't give any value for the flexibility of the other two, which for us is not intuitive at all. It should be a no-brainer that we do refurbish those six turbines and be able to support any type of crisis, whether it's a long crisis or a small crisis. And that additional flexibility is not recognized by the capacity market.
Okay, so you're sort of doing this work under Norwich, but the current rules essentially only allow you to replace four of the turbines.
Exactly.
But you're essentially saying, well, look, since we're doing all of this work anyway, which is £1 billion worth of investment and work on this site, why not let's just kind of tweak the rules and get these other two done all at the same time?
Yeah, yeah. And it's not about tweaking the rules, and we're not asking anything specific for us. Not at all. It's about recognizing that when we have a shared resource, which is the case, we have the water is shared between our six turbines, then we can use it for 9 hours with four turbines, or we can use it for 6 hours with six turbines. And that's basically what currently the capacity market does not recognize, because they only recognize unit by unit. If we follow strictly the rules, we could claim that each of our units can run for 36 hours. But it's not true.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So essentially saying the because the capacity market pays out different amounts of money depending on the duration that you can provide for.
Yeah.
So for listeners, if you're a very short duration asset, it's like a 1 hour or 2 hour system, instead of getting 100% of a capacity market payment, you would get something like 10 to 20%.
Yeah, it's the rating is really quick and really, really harsh, yes.
Yes, and so if you can be a longer duration asset, you get more of the capacity market payment.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So I think this is where there's the kind of the desire for the capacity market to kind of appreciate that duration is I think the conversation.
Absolutely. And there's not so many assets in the market who have shared resources, but we believe that there will be more and more, you know, when you have for example hydrogen storage developing or compressed air storage or things like that. This will be shared resources, you know, somehow, and will have to be recognized.
Well, let's do that. Let's go into the future. Now you've mentioned hydrogen and sort of compressed air. So like what do you've worked in energy space and as an engineer for many years. So what do you think that kind of next 10, 15 years looks like?
I mean, for hydrogen, it will take a bit more time. That everybody, I think it's no news, it takes a bit more time to get the business case flying. But there's also all the green gas, you know, all the biogas. We do invest quite a lot in biogas. We are one of the major players in Europe for biogas. We are also now starting to invest in the UK and have a really appetite to develop that, because it's a faster, easier way to green the gas that we need. Hydrogen will be there, and we also look at investing in hydrogen, and particularly hydrogen storage in the UK and hydrogen production in other countries. But it will take a longer time to be at industrial scale.
Okay, so you're starting to see a few of these technologies coming through,
yeah,
like biogases, and they might be something we move towards perhaps slightly earlier than, say, hydrogen, but long-term you see hydrogen,
yeah,
alongside things like compressed air being part of the solution.
Absolutely. I mean, hydrogen, yes, absolutely. Especially one of the areas that we need absolutely to invest, and we are investing into that, is how we can green the fleet of CCGT that is existing, because they are also still essential assets.
Yes.
To keep the electricity on and to keep the flexibility that we need. It's very complementary to battery and pump storage. You know, all of that is needed to keep the lights on, and hydrogen and biogas, you know, are ways also to green and decarbonize this fleet. And we need to also, I mean, like for our pump storage, we need to make the most of what we already have.
Yeah,
but it comes with the condition, of course, to decarbonize it as much as we can.
And that was a question I really wanted to ask, which is obviously ENGIE work in many gas projects alongside lots of others, say pumped hydro, solar, wind, battery. But those gas projects, there is a transition going on. You've obviously worked on some of those gas projects as well. So how do you see those sites transitioning?
It's a very broad question. I mean, maybe you want me to talk about storage, for example, because that's an area I know the best. I mean, we currently operate the fastest cycling gas storage in the UK. Maybe you didn't know that. It's near Chester, and it's salt cavities. basically. But you can store anything you want in a salt cavity. And at the moment, we have a project to build new salt cavities to store hydrogen. For me, it's important that, again, we have those assets that have been built, you know, with a lot of ingenuity by our engineers, and they can last forever. Mm-hmm. So we need to use them the best we can. Same for all the gas transportation networks. There's been huge investment in the 1960s, 70s, 80s to develop the gas network. This is easy to transport the molecule that we want and then use it to produce electricity, for example, at the end. This is natural transportation and storage system that already exist. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. I think we do invest into reinventing them with a greener solution and greener gases to flow into them. It would be a far reach to say that we would do we would put hydrogen in the gas network. I don't believe into it, but biogas absolutely. It is something that we're aiming to do more and more biogas in the French network system, and we can do that also in the UK.
Okay, super interesting. I think about batteries. I think about power systems. So I always I like. Transmission lines, perhaps more than like gas pipelines. But I can see there's a world where you need a combination of both to deal with some of the more nuanced parts of power systems, like getting through a winter period when there's no sun, there's no wind, etc.
Absolutely. And the gas system offers a lot of storage and flexibility. It's we don't need to react as instantly as for the grid, the power grid system. You know, it's much more flexible.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you one more question before coming on to the final two. And so, as the managing director of ENGIE's pumped hydro business, I would love to ask you a question about how did you get into the space, and what advice would you give to young people interested in engineering, specifically women who are probably underrepresented in the space?
Well, I probably would start with their parents.
So if you're listening, pass this now over to your parents.
Yeah, no. I mean, when I was an engineer, when I was doing my engineering studies, it was in the late 80s. There was only 15% of ladies, more or less, in the class. And it's still the same today.
Yeah.
So I found that absolutely staggering. And I do believe strongly that it's because we have still a lot of stereotypes in our society. And it starts at a young age. So one of the things I can share with your auditors is that when I was young, well, my dad, he was an electrician, and I was enjoying so much doing DIY with him, you know, I mean, it raised the curiosity. And one of the other things that he was keen on doing, and it was not so fashionable at the time, during holidays, we were visiting a lot of industrial sites. Every year we were visiting a dam or a factory or you name it, you know, and he was himself fascinated by all this engineering success, you know, and what the human brain can put together. I think that's how he raised my curiosity, and I think that's why the advice for me is to the parents: just offer the possibility to your children, you know, to be curious about that and break the stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And dads, especially, ask your daughter to come and do DIY. Maybe she won't like it, but at least she has a chance to try it.
Yeah, I think there's something so magical about genuinely understanding how something works.
Yeah,
is so much of kind of I think what started me on a journey towards engineering and keeps like my interest in the energy space as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's about opening up the minds of our children first of all. And then for the less young auditors, I think they need to find some mentors if they are really interested in the technical space. You know, I think if they can find some mentors, some people who help them nourishing their curiosity and maybe opening doors also for apprenticeship training, etc. I think it's something that they need to try. Okay. I mean, work experience, for example, we have possibility to do work experience when we are at high school. I think in the UK, try to do something in the technical space and see if you're interested or not.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a really interesting space about how do you move the needle on getting more people into certain topics. It's just
absolutely, absolutely. And I still don't understand why people are not so keen on doing that.
Yeah, I think every industry says that. Every industry is kind of a little bit passionate about their own space and never really understands why other people don't share the same enthusiasm.
But when you see what the type of realization that the human brain and the human teams, you know, can put together.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I mean, caverns the size that St. Paul's Cathedral can fit into, 2.5 meter wide valves, the largest valves in the world, specially being manufactured and shipped. You've got the power system, which is the largest machine on earth.
Like, absolutely.
How can you not be interested?
Yeah, and the teamwork also, the passion of people working together. It's more than 50% of the success of the project. It's the team. It's the people.
Okay. I'm going to move us on to our final two questions. Mm-hmm. The first one is there anything you'd like to plug?
Maybe a couple of things, if I may.
Of course.
One, I want to repeat that I think we need to do the most of what we have. Of course, we need to invest for the future. We are doing that. We are investing in the renewable space, in the batteries, etc. But we need also to do the most, to take the most and decarbonize what we have, because it's probably a harder way to go, because it requires industrial skills, industrial knowledge, technical skills. But it's a much more sustainable way to continue the journey towards a greener energy. And the other thing I'd like to plug, I think we are fortunate that in the first hydro assets we have are in North Wales. It's a beautiful area, but it's a bit remote. But we will need to recruit more and more talents in the future to deal with our new refurbished assets. And we are keen also to take on board apprentices and trainees. So, it's maybe far away, but there's so much things that are interesting in this area.
Well, maybe just let's put a bit of context on that. So how many people work at Dunorwig? Are we talking 5, 10, 500?
At the moment, we have permanent jobs. We have 180 people.
Okay.
But we are, of course, attracting a lot of other people to support our projects and also through our subcontractors. So, yes.
There's all the additional work going into this.
All the additional work, absolutely. Okay. And we take regularly apprentices and trainees. Yeah.
Okay, that's great news. And then on to my final question. So, is there a contrarian view you hold, something that you believe that others don't?
I think I already said it when I talk about making the most of the assets we have for the future. I think it's also important to invest in that. But it's not an easy path for all investors. Absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay. Delphine, thank you very much for your time and your expertise. It's been a fascinating listen to get
thank
the
you.
History of pumped hydro, as well as everything that's going on within this fascinating business. I'm very excited to see what comes next.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. And it was my pleasure.